Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at AccelerateShares.com.
Welcome, ladies and gents, to the Absolute Return Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Julian Klimochko. I'm joined by my co-host, Mike Kesslering. And on today's podcast, we welcome special guest, SPAC Guru, a widely followed pseudonymous Twitter account. Now, SPAC Guru is a Wall Street veteran and an expert, as you can guess, on the SPAC market. On today's podcast, SPAC Guru discusses his career background and why he wants to help out individual investors, what the overly negative media gets wrong about SPACs, why SPACs are better than IPOs, the best strategies to invest in SPACs, pitfalls and mistakes that investors should stay away from, and more. So with no further ado, here's our discussion with the SPAC Guru. And we're live with the SPAC Guru himself. We're going to refer to him as G today. G, how are you? Thanks for coming on the Absolute Return Podcast.
Hey, Julian. Thanks for having me. It's great seeing you on CNBC. I like that we have a little representation now.
Yeah, that's great. And actually asked me on to come on again, which is why I'm wearing the tie here. So that'll be on in a few hours. But by the time we publish this, it'll be long in the past. But nonetheless, super excited to have you on the show today to talk about SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, blank checks, and all that good stuff. And so I invited G on the show. Really, it stemmed from a recent discussion on Clubhouse with the Forest Road acquisition team, sponsor team, and Andrew Ross Sorkin, who is a CNBC journalist, contributor. And Andrew Ross Sorkin has had a negative bias towards SPACs. Everyone knows that. He complains that post-SPAC equities do poorly, retail gets ripped off, they're bag holders, et cetera, et cetera. And G came on and really countered that. And I found that it was a refreshing voice to have in the market to preach the benefits of SPACs. With any asset class, there's obviously positives and negatives. And I found it, you know, really stunning to see certain journalists super negative on, say, SPACs, for example, but then be all rah-rah on IPOs, which retail investors do not have a good experience with at all. But I digress. G, I want to welcome you to the show and really give you a platform to have your voice heard with respect to the SPAC market and the positives that you're seeing and your thoughts on the market. Can you follow it closely? But prior to getting into that, for those unaware of what the SPAC Guru is all about, you want to give a quick background. And keep in mind for the listeners is that you are an anonymous or pseudonymous account on Twitter with a large following, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Hey, thanks. So just to give everybody a quick background, I started on Wall Street in the early 90s. There's a lot of people that I knew. It was a much different time on Wall Street. You could walk into the New York Stock Exchange. There were not armed guards there with machine guns. The roads weren't blocked. We played stickball in front of the New York Stock Exchange. And after the close, there would even be times when you could walk in with a beer in your hand and see some of your friends, and nobody really cared. So I started back then. There's a lot of people who I know that are either sponsors or investment bankers or pipe people, you name it. Because I was actually there at some point early on in my career. I've later gone on to do some SPACs myself. I shouldn't say that. I did a lot of mergers and acquisitions. I've never actually did a SPAC, but I did SPAC-like products. And I was very close with a lot of the GKN guys early on, which if you know your SPAC history, those are the fellows, the three guys over at GKN were guys who basically put this whole thing together. They're better known now, some of them as Early Bird Capital. And because I know SPAC sponsors, pipe investors, some of the targets, and because I was also the president and CEO of public and private companies, and I ran a fund for a while, so it's just easiest for me to stay anonymous And it's not for any other reason. I've never had any problems, no sanctions or fines from the SEC. So it's nothing nefarious like that. It's just a lot easier. And I like my anonymity. I do this for free. I do it to be kind and help, because when I started out, people were kind and helped me. So with that as my background, now we can go on to some of our SPAC talk.
Yeah, definitely. Super Julie, excited to get into it. And specifically, I wanted to start out what you're discussing with Andrew Ross Sorkin. So his viewpoint, and we see this many in the media. And one thing that I wanted to straighten out is, you know, SPACs have really come onto the scene since last summer. It's really when the boom started, and front page news every day for 8-9 months already, and top of mind for the media, investors, etc. Like, SPACs are this massive, massive thing. And there was a huge boom. They went from, you know, last year, $20 billion, a backwater asset class that you talk about a SPAC, no one had any idea what the heck you're talking about. Now, everyone knows they've gone up 10x year over year in terms of aggregate market capitalization, now above $200 billion. However, that still pales in comparison to the private equity, which is like north of $3 trillion in the global private equity industry, to hedge funds. Global hedge funds, I believe, are $2.5 trillion. And venture capital is, I believe, you know, perhaps around $1 trillion. But nonetheless, the SoftBank Vision Fund itself is $100 billion, half the entire SPAC market. Now, you know, there's 552 SPACs outstanding, the average size roughly $300 million. So yes, there is a lot. However, you got to remember, these are micro companies. And if we aggregate them all, like say they control roughly $175 billion in trust or so, $180 billion, they typically do the average deal 3 to 5x trust value. So in aggregate, call that, you know, $600 to $700 million deal value if every single one of them gets a deal done. And that aggregate deal value, if you think about it on a fair comparison, that equals one Tesla, one Tesla market cap. So just to give you a sense of the size of how it's sort of overblown in terms of frenzied activity, I think it was just an asset class in bloom. But onto the negative bias within the media that was discussed on this recent Clubhouse episode, specifically Andrew Ross Sorkin was very negative on the asset class. He said specifically that retail investors were getting ripped off. What are your thoughts on that, G?
Well, anybody who watches CNBC, and especially in the morning, you could see Andrew Ross Sorkin and David Faber and Jim Cramer talk about SPACs like they're the Ponzi scheme of 2021. And it aggravates the heck out of me. And one of the things is Jim Cramer will talk trash about SPACs in the morning, but if one of these SPACs goes on mad money in the evening, he'll kiss their ass in Macy's window. It's a bipolar. He's there for entertainment. Please don't listen to any of his advice, anyone. And if you don't believe me, go look up his returns in his charitable trust versus the S&P. He underperforms. So anyhow, with saying that, we were on Clubhouse, and I'll address later why I'm on Clubhouse. But we were on Clubhouse, and we were on with the Forest Road sponsors, symbol FRX, who was doing Beachbody. And they were nice enough to have Julian and I on. And when I saw that Andrew Sorkin was on, they said, here we go. I'm going to be nice, and I'm not disrespectful, and I don't speak over people, and I don't curse and raise my voice. But I said to him, I said, hey, Andrew, you know, you're really hard on SPACs. And he went on to say that SPACs historically underperform and they're historically terrible for retail investors and all the negative things that we know, such as there's 500 of them out there and there's, you know, it's unsustainable and that type of thing. Well, that's fine. And I do agree there's a lot. And I do agree what Julian said, one Tesla is more than all of them combined on their best day. But with that being said, it's not bad for retail, in my opinion. And this is what I told him. I said, on CNBC, a company can do an IPO. And whatever that company is, whether it's DoorDash, Airbnb, Affirm, you name it. And it's priced, I'll make up a hypothetical. An IPO is priced at $25. they open it at 60. It's 60.
Yeah.
So that's the first print. So any retail investor who wants to own any of these new hot IPOs is already buying an over 100% gain from a fund or an institution that's owned the stock literally for, you know, a half a day. And what happens is these retail folks will go in and they'll buy this IPO up at 60. And a lot of times we'll watch it trade flat or we'll watch it trade down. And for the retail investor, they're not getting any of this allocation
right
at the IPO price. They're buying it in the secondary market and they do terrible. And if you are sitting in front of a Quotron, you can look at any of them. But the thing that makes me aggravated is that CNBC will go on and they will bang the drum of what a successful IPO it was. And we just had one not too long ago, forgetting which one it was, but the first tick was at $70. And it traded nothing but down from 70 and it closed at 60. There was not an uptick for the whole day. And they said, what a great success it was. Well, anybody who's a retail investor or trader, it was a miserable failure.
Yeah.
Because it only went down regardless of where you bought it. So for them to say something is a tremendous success because they got the IPO off, well, it was a failure in many places. One of the failures, it was a failure to the company that went public because they didn't price it right.
Right.
You know, if you're going to price something at $25 and it opens at 60, if I was the target company, if I was the company doing my IPO, that's horrible. And I'll give you another example. If you look, one of the stocks was Loan Depot. And I kind of like Loan Depot as a company. And it was a lot of selling shareholders and founders in the IPO. And they opened it at the low end of the range. The range was 13 to say, who knows, $13 to $18. Well, they opened it at 13. Well, go look at the chart on that. They opened this thing up in the 20s.
Yep, 22 bucks.
Now, if you're a founder and you started a company from scratch, that's really harsh. They take you out of 13 and it opens, you know, 15%.
Yeah, they're basically higher. Selling shares way too cheap and suffering undue dilution to the business.
Exactly. But Goldman Sachs and everybody who was on the book, they got their piece. They got their investment banking fee. They got their overallotment. They got their underwriter's warrants. And yeah, it was a successful IPO. The company did raise some money. Goldman Sachs made, and all the bankers, they got all of their fees, which I'm not saying they're not entitled to. You know, you work, you're entitled to make your fees. It's all disclosed. But there's such a huge disconnect in the pricing. There's such a huge disconnect that this was a great deal. It was a great deal for the chosen ones. It was a great deal for the 1%, the funds, the institutions, the college endowments. It wasn't a good deal for, you know, John Doe.
And specifically, so you're mentioning the institutional investor is buying at the IPO $13, flipping the next day to retail at $22 when it starts trading.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's who's buying it from them. Retail's buying it from them.
Yeah.
And again, whether that's fine or that's not fine, retail money goes where it's treated best.
Yep.
And if somebody wants to go and buy that, that's fine. But when they go on CNBC and when Andrew Ross Sorkin says, retail investors are going to get killed. They're going to get killed. Retail investors get killed all the time.
Yeah.
Retail investors are the dumb money. When retail investors are buying, you should be selling. And when they're selling, you should be buying. We know that. And the difference for me with SPACs is you get to know, it's almost like a hurricane versus an earthquake. When people have an earthquake and terrible destruction happens, it catches everybody by surprise. You could be laying in bed, you could be walking down the street, you could be in your office, and all of a sudden the earth starts moving. There's nothing you could do. But a hurricane, you know its name, you know where it came from, you know when it's coming, you know about how big it's going to be. And that's kind of like a SPAC to me. A SPAC is I get to know how much money they have to go shopping with. So I have a ballpark, like you said, Julian, 3 to 5x of their SPAC size. Now, we also know that sometimes they use a pipe.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, my number, my back of the envelope quick number is they could go 6 times if they really wanted to.
Right.
So I say, okay, well, here we go. And here's the sponsor group. And this is their pedigree. This is their story. This is what they've done. And I say, okay, I like whomever it may be. I like Eric Schmidt. I like Michael Dell. I like KKR. I like Chamath. I like Michael Klein. Whoever it is you like or dislike, you can make that decision and you have plenty of time.
In terms of SPAC
sponsor. Well, you know before it even comes out. And then the unit lists. So then the unit comes out. And here's another thing you know. In an IPO, you don't know how many underwriters over allotment shares you're buying.
Yep.
You don't know all of these different things. But in a SPAC, you know that all the funds and all the institutions and all the guys who are getting to buy all the IPOs at half price before they sell them, you know they're buying these units roughly at 10 for the most part. There are the outliers.
Yep.
But you know where the competition is. You know where the overhang is. Now, I, for example, if I like a deal and I like a sponsor group and that unit comes out, let's say hypothetically at $10.50, let's just say I do a quick look and I'll just say it's a quarter of a warrant. Well, a lot of warrants trade in that $1.50 to $2 range. So just for mathematical reasons, we'll just say, we'll assume that the warrant might be $2.
Yep.
Well, if you bought a unit at $10.50 and it's got a quarter of a warrant, there's a good chance you're going to be able to sell that quarter of a warrant for that 50 cents. And then you have the redemption backstop. So you've basically were able to buy a call option on a sponsor team you like, with a focus you like, with a bank account that you think they could do something decent. And you're in at a small premium at 10.50, you're in at 5% over Blackstone, BlackRock, KKR, whoever it may be. That's pretty good for a retail investor who's used to buying the 100% plus gain from these folks. And then, of course, there's what Julian does. When it goes below that, you own it for less than they own it.
Yeah.
And that takes all your risk away. So for Julian, for myself, for a lot of the people listening to this and a lot of the SPAC investors, there's many, many strategies. Some people sell the warrant. Some people sell the common and keep the warrant for free. You know, there's lots of ways to do it. So when I was on with Clubhouse and I was telling Andrew Sorkin how I felt, he was a gentleman. He listened. He didn't speak over me. And when I say he listened, he didn't just sit there quietly. He actually responded. And he told me things about him that I never would have thought of. And one of the things he said that was really interesting was, in the financial collapse, him as a reporter and many of the people at CNBC took an awful lot of heat for not trying to call it a bubble or deflate it or warn people.
Right.
So, you know, for him to have a little bit of baggage from that, that's something that I never thought of. And the old walk a mile in someone else's shoes was pretty interesting. But on the same token, I think him listening to me about how they cheer about IPOs and how successful they are, and in the same breath will say that retail is going to get killed in SPACs. What I said to him is they say SPAC almost like the old gypsy woman in a movie who will put a curse on someone and then spit on the floor. It's when they say SPAC, they say it with such disgust and disdain. And they just mock flying cars and the Jetsons, and they say every bad thing they could say, but you never really hear them give the credit for the ones that people like. You don't, when they talk about DraftKings, once in a while they'll say it's a SPAC, but you never hear them talk about Utz potato chips, which a lot of people say Utz, and I did as well until I heard one of the family members refer to her name as Utz. So, you know, there are things out there that you could, Utz was a SPAC that pays a dividend. So this isn't 2026 revenue, but there are a lot of them. And as we saw, when EV was hot, it was all EVs.
Yeah.
When gaming's hot, it's all gaming.
Yeah.
When charging is hot, how many chargers came out? I never heard of LiDAR or Validyne.
Right.
And now what is there, six LiDAR SPACs?
Yep, half a dozen.
So as we could see, you know, it's a group mentality. It's the hot, shiny object. And retail investors do usually get killed. But the retail investors who get killed in SPACs are not the early adapters. They're not the ones who are watching the filings and reading, you know, Julian's tweets about a new deal that priced. They're the ones who are the YOLO FOMO, let's go buy this hot new deal that's trading through 20.
Yep.
And then they all say they're bag holders, and it drives me crazy because they don't ever have to hold a bag, as they call it.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest-growing alternative investment solution providers, with a suite of institutional-caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund, symbol ARB on the TSX, is the world's first SPAC-focused ETF with a diversified portfolio of SPAC and merger arbitrage opportunities in an easy-to-use, low-cost ETF. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF trades under the symbol ARB on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Yeah, and especially when you mentioned that, I mean, looking at the FOMO or meme investors that buy CCIV at, you know, $40 or $50 and then see it go back down to 20 and complain about that. That argument doesn't really carry a lot of weight with me. But
well, from that perspective, that I wanted to mention, like, one inherent negative media bias that really aggravates me specifically is, say, on that example of a SPAC that goes from 60 to 20, they're like, oh, it's down by 66%. It's just gotten crushed. I'm like, listen, it IPO'd last summer at $10. People who bought are up over 100%. So the key is, you know, at least a balanced view. Mention, hey, this thing went public at $10. It's more than doubled. Anyone who was disciplined in their buying made a ton of money, outperformed dramatically. Why don't you mention that as well? Not just 100% focused on the negative, but Mike, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just going to ask... I'm very curious on, we've kind of talked about the two alternatives for going public being either a SPAC or a traditional IPO process. What's your view on direct listings in that same conversation?
Well, if you're asking me, you know, that's a different animal. A direct listing is almost the polar opposite of a SPAC. You're going into... The target's going into the SPAC knowing that there's money in escrow that they're going to get their hands on, most likely to execute their plan. Seems like these direct listings, a lot of them are selling shareholders. We saw that with Palantir.
Yep.
The one that comes to mind, one that just came out, which was, you don't hear anybody on CNBC, you know, pimping Oscar Healthcare. That was selling shareholders. They brought that out at the high end of the range, and it got pummeled. So... Again, when people say, well, these direct listings, that's going to be the end of SPACs. It's not going to be the end of SPACs. And a SPAC is a different walk than an IPO. It's you're doing the SPAC because, A, you don't want to take the time and go through the IPO process. A lot of people, B, are taking the SPAC route because they actually want the sponsors to be involved. They want some adult supervision. They want people who are movers and shakers in industries to open doors for them. So if you're a company, if you're a target company, and you have a whole bunch of spec sponsors courting you and wanting to do a deal, and they're all reasonably within the amount of money that you want for evaluation and have enough cash to execute on your plan, I could see you taking less money to go with a sponsor who you believe in.
Right.
Would you rather go with Harry Sloan for a little less money than a sponsor group that it's their first SPAC?
Mm-hmm.
So again, you have to weigh the pros with the cons. And I think the good thing for me and for Julian and for retail investors is that now with so many of these SPACs online, there's so many different trades and investments you can make. But the better side of the equation is that with so many of them chasing the same targets, you know, the targets had all the leverage.
Yep.
So we'll go back and talk about Churchill Capital. Churchill Capital had to make a terrible deal because Lucid had their feet to the fire.
Yeah, and the market forced their hand there. They really had no choice, just given where the stock was trading.
Well, let's just think of it. And I don't know Michael Klein. I never spoke to him. So this is all speculation, but I try to put myself in his shoes. You're Michael Klein, and you're trying to negotiate on behalf of Churchill Capital and the SPAC holders and the shareholders. And every day you watch the stock trade 100 million shares, and it's up $1, $5, $10, $20, $50. It makes negotiation incredibly hard when you're trying to get a good valuation for your team.
And I should note that was the media's fault, because they leaked the deal and continued to leak certain details and hype the stock, which got retail investors, you know, really enthusiastic about it. You saw chat rooms, Wall Street Bets, you know, the SPAC channel blow up with activity based off these media, these journalist reports on when then they're slagging these deals. But on the other hand, they're the ones out causing some of these issues.
Let me ask you this. During this whole thing and the negativity during the SPACs, did you see that CNBC was showing Lucid commercials in every commercial break? At no point did they say, hey, this SPAC deal is nonsense and retail investors are going to get screwed. We're going to actually do the right thing. And we're not going to show the Lucid Air car that's not even ready to be sold yet on our TV every commercial break.
Right, right.
And so again, it's incredibly biased. It's polar opposite. You know, do as I say, not as I do. If they really wanted to take the high and mighty road, they could. But they don't. And, you know, they're a business. They're an entertainment company. They want eyes. And most people I know are not buying Boeing and Bank of America. So that's what they're used to talking about. So anything new gets fought. And anything that's not the norm is bad. And it's not bad. There are bad things. But, you know, how often, who is pounding the table more about Enron and WorldCom and Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and, you know, go down the whole list of all these things that just got blown up for big money, for more money than the whole SPAC universe was before 2020.
Mm-hmm.
But you never hear that.
And now a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest growing alternative investment solution providers, with a suite of institutional caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance. The Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF, symbol 1C, ONEC on the TSX, is Canada's first alternatives portfolio solution, providing exposure to 6 alternative asset classes, 10 alternative strategies, in one easy-to-use, one-choice ETF that charges a management fee of just 0.2%. The Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF trades under the symbol 1C, ONEC, on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. Another common criticism that I wanted to discuss, and this has really come up lately, is, you know, one of the tools that companies going public via SPAC utilize are forecasts for guidance, which obviously aren't allowed within the context of a traditional IPO. However, many of the companies going public via SPAC are earlier stage, and even professional investors want to see, you know, some sort of forecast. Look, where do you see this business heading? What are your goals? What's your budget? Not to mention, basically, nearly every public company produces forecasts or have sell-side analysts providing those estimates for investors. And so what are your thoughts on, like, a lot of these SPACs being sold off forward guidance and forecasts that many view as too aggressive? For example, over the past couple of weeks, we saw a number of post-SPAC equities focused in the EV sector that revised their forecast, at least in the near term, down dramatically. And that's where a lot of the attention is these days. Obviously, the media tends to not mention the ones that raise guidance, which actually does happen, whether it's one like Playboy. They just raised their guidance pretty significantly and has been a slam dunk of a post-SPAC equity, now trading at 20 and change. But I digress. Gee, what are your thoughts on the notion of forecasts and how the market interprets that?
Well, I'm a big fan of full disclosure and transparency. So I like it when we see things like this. I also like to underpromise and overperform, but you also have a responsibility and an obligation, a fiduciary duty to be transparent and share as much as you can with your shareholders and the public as possible. And as far as, you know, buy side and all of these different things kind of converge on SPACs. And you know better than anyone, that's why we see some of these SPACs trading below net asset value. And what a lot of the retail investors don't realize is, you know, some of these people in their book, their risk department will look at their book and say, okay, great, you own a little bit too many of these, you know, you need to come out of them. Mm-hmm. And nobody kind of wraps their head around why somebody who paid $10 for something, who's a big fund, who has billions of dollars under management, would sell a SPAC unit at $9.75. So I think that the education still needs to improve for retail folks. And as far as what you were saying with the EV companies, and whether we say it's EV or LIDAR or charging or batteries or whatever it might be, water seeks its own level. And the competition kind of takes a lot of the people's eye off the ball. So when Velodyne was the only LIDAR play, it was easy. Oh, LIDAR. Well, that's pretty cool technology. I want to be involved with some LIDAR. And Desktop Metal, they said, hey, we're the first pure play 3D printer. Wow, that's really cool. Well, now how many more do we have? So it's the same thing whether you're looking at over 500 SPACs or if you're looking at first to market or then you're looking at copycat sponsors. It's almost like what happened with GameStop. If the Wall Street Bets guys would have just stayed focused on the GameStop, they probably could have got it to 1,000 and put all their rocket emojis and ate their tendies and believed in all those things. But then they started saying, well, we're going into AMC and we're going into Express and we're going into Naked Brands and, you know, just go on and on. We're going to corner the market in silver.
Do you
not know how the silver ETFs work? You're not. There is no short squeeze in silver. You're buying the suits, the holdings. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a cyclical process. We always have to adapt. What worked yesterday does not work today. You know, SPACs for 6 months were the easiest game in town.
Yeah.
You buy on the news, you take the SPAC pop, you know, rinse and repeat. And it was incredibly easy. Look at stocks like the HOL. That news came out, it spiked. It went, over $20 a share. And there's lots of stories like that. And I remember when STIC, BarkBox announced.
Yeah.
The day of the announcement, pre-market, what a trade, $14, $15, $16, something like that. It's $11 now.
That was the norm.
You don't have to rush out. Right. That was the norm.
Yeah.
And the people who held the bags were the people who read an announcement, didn't know what they were buying, were buying a 40% gain off of people like us. And then they say, oh, I held the bags. And another thing is, a lot of people who really get hurt are the people who are buying these illiquid investments after hours.
Yep.
You can see incredible, incredible moves after hours. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of money to be made. There are people who make money after hours, and that's all they do. But you can't be everything. You can't be a specialist in after hours trading, SPACs, warrants, units, arbitrage. You kind of have to find your own lane.
Yeah.
And that's what we try to help people do.
For sure. And I want to touch on the warrants because that's one thing that I'm seeing that's highly disconcerting. You have retail investors talk about their portfolios and it's stuffed with warrants, which are effectively highly leveraged bets on already extremely volatile assets. And, you know, there's not a lot of risk management there. In my opinion, what are your thoughts on, you know, retail investors, are any investors holding outright warrants and speculating in warrants?
Well, we have a great thing that we could point to that just happened recently. So if we all go and look at Romeo Power, symbol yep. RMO, they met the criteria of their stock trading price. It maintained for the period that they needed to maintain. And the company came out and announced, we are going to be exercising and calling all of our publicly traded warrants. And the stock went into a free fall. Mm-hmm. And the stock traded below the warrant exercise price. And the warrants expired pretty close to worthless. And if you weren't smart enough to sell them all the way till the end, you were blessed with a penny in your account the next day for every one of them you had. Now, ironically, right after all the warrants died, the company came out with great news and the stock surged. But the thing is, when people DM me and they say, no, the warrants can't be called because I'm on my brokerage account and it's telling me that my warrant expires this date in 2026. I say, well, yeah, that's the date that your brokerage account put on the website because that's the day that the merger happened and that's the countdown of the life expectancy of your warrant. But your warrant took a different path. Your warrant got called. And when people say, well, what does that mean? If you own a warrant, you don't know your warrant was called or what that even means. Obviously, you shouldn't own warrants.
Right.
And I think a lot of retail investors look at, well, heck, this thing's $12 and I could buy the $2 warrant and I could go dollar for dollar with it like a call. Well, go look at QuantumScape. How many people got their asses kicked on that? They were short the common and they were buying the warrant thinking that they had cheap protection. Mm-hmm. But the warrant, the underlying warrant did not have an open or an active registration.
Right.
So if you were short the common and you were long the warrant, that really didn't help you. And if you look at the divergence between the common price and the warrant price, people are saying, well, the warrant should be $11.50 less. And it was incredibly undervalued according to those metrics. But what people didn't take into account was there's a lot of risk and there's no registration. So, you're going to have to hold this.
Yeah. And by registration, you mean that investors, warrant holders weren't able to exercise the warrants.
Correct. So you think that if you have your warrant and you have your $11.50, you can go to the counter and redeem it for your share. Well, that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get a rain check and they say, well, you can redeem it for your share when there's an active registration for us to convert those warrants into shares. But unfortunately, under our registration statement, we don't need to do it at this time.
Right.
So again, warrants are very risky. Warrants can go to zero. As we know, if you own a unit or a common and you want to redeem at redemption, you can. So if you have the unit, you can redeem the common, but the warrant's yours to keep. You can sell it. You could hang it on your wall. It could go to zero. And another thing that we see that people just get killed on is if you spend $2 for a warrant and the stock's say $11.50, mm-hmm. and then the stock goes to below 10 and the warrant goes to under a dollar.
Yeah.
Well, now you're down 50% on your warrant. And now, you're flipping out. Because you look at your portfolio and people say, well, it's only a dollar. It's only $2. Well, don't look at it like that. If you just bought $5,000 worth of them, it's not only, a dollar. You bought $5,000 worth. Now it's worth $2,500. So, we know that. Some of the sophisticated people know that, or not even sophisticated, but a lot of young people they don't know, or people who are new to investing. And, we really try our best to get everybody to know what they own or what they're going to buy.
Yeah, those warrants are effectively highly leveraged bets on micro cap, highly volatile stocks, and investors need to keep that in mind. And so I threw it out there that you're coming on the show just on my Twitter feed asking if anyone had any questions. A popular one that I did get was, we just went through a SPAC bear market. What are your thoughts on the market? Where are you seeing risks and opportunities?
I see risks in any of these SPACs that de-SPAC and took off.
Right.
Because as we see, more and more competition keeps coming to market. I see incredible value in buying units below $10. I'm just looking at some of my screens now, and some of these teams, I'll just ramble a couple of them off. XPOA, and it has Eric Schmidt involved.
Yep.
ZNTE. Go look at the sponsor team on that. ZNTE is trading at $10.04 for the common. The XPLA is trading at $9.97.
We own both of those.
Yeah, it's not as much. Yeah, it's not as much fun as chasing XL when it goes up, you know, 10-20% a day. And everybody is telling me that Pershing Square is cheap. Well, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe it's $5 over net asset value.
Yep.
So I don't know, 25% over net asset value. I don't know, is that cheap?
Yeah.
Maybe.
It is the most expensive out there, for sure. And, you know, the SPACs that you commented on are the ones that are, you know, high-quality sponsors that are around net asset value. So low downside risk and, you know, good upside optionality potential. And that's the type of strategy that I consider it more of a get rich slowly, because you stand a very low chance of losing money as long as you affect this strategy correctly and don't hang on to a bad deal, de-SPAC. And in addition, you pitch that to investors, but I think a key lesson for investors who perhaps lost some money trading SPACs at the frenzy is that, you know, that the get-rich-quick schemes, like, that never works. And it doesn't work in stocks, it doesn't work in SPACs, it doesn't work anywhere, and the strategy that you are promoting, affecting, and the way to do well in SPACs is more so a strategy that requires patience.
It does. It requires, not only does it require patience, but one of the things that I just started doing, and it's actually fairly interesting, is I'm buying some of these units at or below the net asset value. And what I did is I set up a secondary account. Now, this is in my self-directed IRA. I set up a new account in my self-directed IRA that when the units split upon the de-SPAC, I take my warrants and I just journal them into a different account. Mm-hmm. And I don't look at them, and I don't even really, that's just like the added bonus. That's the cherry on top.
It's free money.
I'm mostly looking at it's the free money. And not only is it the free money, but that's the one that if you catch the MP materials or you catch the DraftKings or you catch one of these, not only did you have your initial buy, which was a smart buy, and again, even if you kicked it out at $15 to $20, 50 to 100% return, well, now tucked away in this other little account, I have 60 different positions that I have no cost in.
Right.
And that little stinky account that I just kind of throw the scraps in, if you extrapolate that number over however many years we could do this with these SPACs,
yep,
that's going to be a pretty significant little bonus account. So again, there's a lot of ways to do this, loading up your portfolio with warrants. And, you know, there's some people you just can't knock them. They say, hey, that's where the bang is. And one of the accounts that I follow is SPAC Warrants, a guy named Jeff on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I think he's at SPAC Warrants. Guy's brilliant. And he knows his game. And he'll go in and he'll buy. And I'll just name a couple of them just because people always say you never name enough names. This OCAXW, it's 57 cents. And he says that he's willing to buy things like this in the hole. And during the dark days when the financial crisis hit in March, he said some of these warrants were a penny to a nickel bid. You know, that's terrifying.
Right.
But if you loaded the gun on penny to nickel warrants and they came out they named even a bad deal, you had a pretty good day. So his claim is he never buys a warrant believing he's going to make less than 8x.
Right.
And he has his numbers to back it, but he also has a 5-year window. He's not impatient. And he has monstrous returns, but he also has incredible swings. His good days are good and his bad days are bad.
Plus, I'm sure, you know, but highly sophisticated, doing the due diligence, reading all the documents, the S-1, the registration statement, etc., to know the exact terms, know when these things are getting called, know when they could get called, and knowing the relevant risks, right? It's all about being informed and intelligent. And in addition to that, just having a strategy that you're confident works and that you're going to stick with.
Well, yeah, and that's a great point. The other day he said to me, he said, just so you know, charge point and skills are in a position that they can call the warrants.
Yeah.
So again, as we know, when the warrants get called, that's usually put some selling pressure on the common. So again, just knowing that, even if you don't own the warrants, just knowing that you're now in the window where they can, might be something that you could plan for now and take a preemptive move. So this way you don't get caught by storm. Don't be in the earthquake. go to the hurricane. You know when they're coming.
Yeah, for sure. So speaking of natural disasters and how investors can sidestep them, do you have any other advice for SPAC investors out there looking for some tips from the guru himself?
I'm going to ask you, you know all the numbers. You know all the... What's a good money manager return a year?
Well, it depends on, you know, the volatility, the strategy, but I think something in the high single digit range, 7 to 8% annualized over the long term, that's consistent. I think that is a good expectation to have.
Well, the reason I ask you, and that's right about where my answer would have been, but I knew you would know it cold. People pay managers. People pay people to manage their money. And their expectation is high single digit consistent returns. So if you take that and you just go and you buy SPACs at or below net asset value as units, and you're not chasing anything, you're going to outperform most money managers who are getting paid to be money managers.
Right.
And, you know, everybody's wants to have, oh, I'm looking for 100 bagger. This is, you know, 100 baggers. Yeah, you'll hit one. You'll miss 1,000 before you hit that one. And again, I say it every chance I can. Please stop sending me diamond hands. When I just a real quick, and I know we're over time. And thank you so much, Julian. When the Churchill Capital, when the CCIV Lucid deal was trading, and one night I went to sleep, and I was very fortunate that this was a big SPAC with over $1 billion in it. It was below net asset value. And I used it to park cash. I had money in my account that I wasn't using. And after the DirecTV rumor on Churchill came out, it was trading well, well below that $10 rate.
Yeah, 980,
so
990.
I said, okay. And I said, I'm gonna put some money in here. And if I need it, I can access it. And who knows, maybe they'll do a deal. Or maybe I'll just have to take the redemption. And the whole Lucid thing came out. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I'm telling this story is one night I went to sleep and the stock was in its 30s. And I still had my full position in my trading account. This is not talking about my IRA or anything like that. This was my trading account. And based on dollar value, it was a monster position that I typically don't go that much at risk. Mm-hmm. And I'm laying in bed and I'm thinking, this deal isn't a done deal. This is a rumor. They were rumored that they were going to do Topgolf. That fell through. They rumored that they were going to do DirecTV. That never happened. And now this thing's $35. And basically, I own a $10 bill that I could sell for $35. So I started scaling out of it. And I started thinking to myself, do I tell anybody? So I said, you know what? I'm going to tell people what I did and why. And I posted that. And I was called incredibly terrible things. I was told, well, you know, that I had no testosterone. I was called paper hands. I was told that I was short. I was told that I was hurt because it was going to 100 and I sold too soon. And I'm like, no, I'm not any of those things. I still own some in my IRA. They're like, well, you said you sold it. So anyhow, that was my public feed. And that kind of gets you a little down, or you want to just say, you know, the hell with this and turn it off my account. I don't care.
Right.
I'm not getting paid for this. What do I need this shit for?
Yeah, exactly.
But in my direct messages were, hey, I was thinking the same thing when I saw you sold, you know, that, and I paid off my student loan. I paid off my car. I'm not in debt anymore. I moved out of my parents' house. The good things that came through. Now, granted, it kept going higher. And I was mocked and shamed and all of those type of things. But when the music stopped and there were no seats left, all those people who posted the diamond hand, now all of a sudden they were complaining they were bag holders and SPACs suck and it's a scam and they got screwed.
Yep.
So, you know, don't be that guy. Know what you're buying. You know, weigh your risk and reward. $35, my downside was 10. I didn't know what my upside was. And the last thing, and then I'll go. When you see a company is going to buy a target that you like, and we've seen this happen, people were very bullish. They wanted eToro. They wanted Sport Radar. They wanted Re Automotive. And they were all coming up with all these different things of what spec they wanted them to go in and why. But what you can do is you can go to sites like Crunchbase or PitchBook, and you can see if they did different rounds of financing and what was the last round they did and what was their valuation and how much money did they raise. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you went and did that with Lucid, which I did, you go and say, well, okay, well, in 2018, they raised this much money $18 billion valuation. Well, okay, well, it's probably worth more now. But if they were worth $18 billion 2 years ago, you know, what are they worth now? They still don't have any products to sell. And I'm not saying you don't buy the future and the technology. So I started running some numbers and I said, okay, well, the SPAC has $2 billion in it. Not thinking of an additional $2 billion pipe, but I'm thinking, well, at the end of the day, the shareholders are only going to come away with this percentage of the company, and we don't know what the valuation is going to be. And the higher the valuation, the smaller. So on the back of an envelope, you start scratching down some numbers, and now you're looking at this thing at $60 a share. And now you start looking at who their market cap is equal to. Mm-hmm. You say, wow, this thing's worth more than Neo, whether you like Neo or not. You say, wow, this is valued. Wow. And now people are saying it's going to go to $100. So you go and throw, you calculate that number and you say, oh, okay, well, they haven't made a car yet. They're going to be worth more than Ford, General Motors, Ferrari. You know, you go down the list. And then it just becomes clear that, you know, some of these things are getting wacky. Mm-hmm. So again, people need to use their common sense.
Well, that's a good spot to wrap things up. Some knowledge, insights, vast experience from the SPAC guru. And folks, if you don't follow him on Twitter, it's a must follow at SPAC guru if you're on the tweet machine. And G, want to thank you for the conversation. Always interesting to hear your insights and experience within the SPAC market because you definitely bring balance. You don't pump, you don't dump, and it's a fair, unbiased comments and, you know, guiding investors on how to make money in this asset class, which ultimately that's the purpose of investing. People want to learn how to make money and you really help them in their journey. So thank you for participating in the Absolute Return podcast and look forward to more conversations in the future.
Great. We'll have to do a clubhouse soon.
All right. Yeah, I'll be on it.
Okay. Thanks, Julian. Thanks, Mike. Great talking with you guys.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.